News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
This is a very important and landmark court ruling, which gives flesh to what would be acceptable and unacceptable, unconstitutional behavior by the state-owned media, which will be important for going forward.
That's attorney Doug Coltart on the Zimbabwe High Court ruling that state media gave disproportionate coverage of political parties in the run-up to elections last year. Details coming up also. An ethnic group in southern Ethiopia has demanded to be granted statehood status. We will have a discussion. And there is a call for a joint Uganda-South Sudan deployment force at their common border to deter the free movement of rebels. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Sidama, the largest of 56 ethnic groups in southern Ethiopia, is demanding statehood status. Since last Thursday, the Sidama zone has witnessed pro-statehood Sidama youths clashing with security forces. Lives have been lost. In fact, the regional government said in a statement the situation had got beyond control of the local security apparatus, and as of last Monday, all zones will be watched temporarily by the federal military and security forces. The latest conflict is another challenge for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has pledged reforms to promote unity. To give us some context as to what triggered the unrest and what might happen next, we have VOA's Salem Solomon in studio. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Salem.
Thanks for having me, as always.
So what is the root cause of this protest?
Well, the Sidama are Ethiopia's fifth largest ethnic group and make up about 4% of the nation's population. Most Sidama live in the state known as the Southern Nations, Nationalities and Peoples Region in southern Ethiopia. But according to Ethiopia's constitution, any ethnicity that wants its own designated region can request a referendum, and it must be held within a year. So the Sidama requested a referendum a year ago and set a deadline for July 18 of this year. That deadline has passed, and there's been no reform or referendum. So members of the Sidama group are protesting, and in fact, activists insist that more unrest is expected if their demands aren't met.
So what does the government say?
Well, the government so far, the Ethiopia's National Election Board, has promised the Sidama they could hold a referendum on having their own region within 5 months. And according to a statement by the Southern Nations, Nationalities and Peoples Region, the regional administration, it's temporarily under federal military command, as you said in your outset, in the outset of this introduction. And the statement says this was necessary because lawlessness and persistent violence in some parts of the region has endangered residents' safety and security. So regional special police forces wearing red beret have been seen in streets of Hawassa, the capital city of the region.
So Salem, what would be the ripple effects of the Sidama if they achieve statehood?
Well, the Sidama believe federal statehood would give them greater autonomy and more control over the region's natural wealth, including its world-famous coffee crop. But there's a possibility that other groups will follow suit. So according to reports from our VOA Horn of Africa service, Amharic service, the SNNPR region is subdivided in 21 zones, and 10 of those zones are already requesting regional status. So other ethnic groups in the SNNPR are also very concerned that the Sidama are seeking to make Hawassa, the capital city, their own state. So the city has a population of about 300,000 and includes sizable population from multiple ethnicities. So observers have voiced their concern that these ethnic groups could reject Sidama rule and revolt in the event of statehood.
VOA Salem Solomon, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
The World Health Organization reports an experimental vaccine is saving lives and slowing the spread of the Ebola virus in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. But as the first anniversary of the epidemic nears, WHO warns many challenges remain to be overcome before this deadly disease is fully contained. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Ebola was declared on August 1, 2018 in DR Congo's conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces. Since then, the World Health Organization has reported more than 2,600 cases, including 1,756 deaths. This is the second worst Ebola outbreak after the 2014 West African epidemic, which killed more than 11,000 people. WHO reports the second wave of the outbreak in the Beni health zone is larger and longer than the first wave 1 year ago. It finds Beni accounts for more than half of the 242 new cases of Ebola reported in the last 3 weeks. Other recent hotspots include Mandima, Mabalako, and Katwa. While this is discouraging, the executive director of WHO Health Emergencies, Mike Ryan, says he is proud of the achievements which have been made. He notes the international operation has prevented the spread of the virus outside North Kivu and Ituri provinces, and there are no confirmed cases in neighboring countries. Ryan says more than 175,000 people have been vaccinated against Ebola as a preventive measure. He tells VOA he has been involved in about 17 Ebola responses over the years, but this is the first time such a valuable life-saving tool has been available.
Ebola is a disease that can be controlled without a vaccine, but in this case, and particularly because we're working in such a very difficult situation, we believe the vaccine has been vital in breaking the chains of transmission.
Well, there's no shortage of the vaccine. Ryan says there are plans to roll out a second experimental vaccine, which would expand the target population to be immunized. He says the use of a second vaccine has the potential to be effective in the fight against Ebola. Ryan says the progress being made is substantial, but challenges remain. Ryan cites security as a major concern. He notes a number of health workers have been killed by armed men and some areas are off limits because of the existing dangers. Ryan says most communities are accepting the need for vaccinations, treatment, and safe burials. But he acknowledges significant pockets of mistrust remain, which hamper efforts to tackle the disease. In addition, he says the operation is badly funded and more than $350 million is needed over the coming months to tackle this devastating disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia says it has stopped issuing visas to people from the DRC over fears Ebola could spread during next month's Hajj pilgrimage. Saudi officials took similar action during West Africa's Ebola outbreak several years ago. South Sudan security officials have asked Uganda for permission to pursue suspected rebels hiding in Ugandan refugee settlements. The officials are also calling for a joint Uganda-South Sudan deployment of forces at the common border to deter the free movement of the rebels accused of destabilizing South Sudan. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
At a latest border meeting between Uganda security officials and their South Sudan counterparts, reports emerged that a number of South Sudan rebels are staying in Ugandan settlements in Kiryandongo, Lamo, and Adjumani disguised as refugees. Alberio Tobiolo Oromo is the governor of Torit State in Eastern Equatorial Province. He told the meeting that some use their status as refugees to steal Ugandan army uniforms, which they use to easily enter South Sudan villages and cause havoc.
And these groups, when you go to the camp of the rebels, you found that they are all on EPDF uniform.
Tobiolo highlighted an incident where suspected rebels pretended to be asylum seekers from Uganda, returning to attend a wedding ceremony in South Sudan, only to later set ablaze an immigration post and an Ebola checkpoint at Owinye Kibul in South Sudan. Nibinson Chidega is the resident district commissioner of Uganda's Lamwo district, who also led the Ugandan security delegation. Although he could not confirm the allegations by South Sudan security officials, he concurred there are indeed suspicious elements within the settlements and promised to investigate further.
I visit the refugees camp. I send my intelligence there. What the governor is saying is true, that the women has no issue, the children has no issue, the youth has no issue. Some of them are vulnerable people, but there are few people who are within. Certain elements there, out and in, as refugees. I don't understand them.
Chidega, however, told the meeting that Uganda is signatory to conventions that prohibit a country from forcefully sending refugees and asylum seekers back to their country of origin.
The UN Convention has covered them. So when they are covered under the MPIT, it is us to draw a strategy. If they are harmful to our society, we need to draw a strategy of how do we manage this.
Tobiolo called for joint efforts to fight the security threat that the rebels pose to both countries.
For us to avoid the movement of small firearms from Uganda to South Sudan, both sides should deploy forces. We must deploy security along the common border to crack those criminals who are moving with the firearms.
The rebels are said to be behind various ambushes along the Nimuli to Juba Highway, which have recently claimed a number of lives, injured scores, most of them traders, and also loss of merchandise. The South Sudan officials are worried that the continued free movement of refugees could jeopardize the recently signed peace agreement between the government and warring factions. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
17 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The Zimbabwe High Court has ruled against state-owned news media over the disproportionate coverage of political parties in the run-up to elections last year. Eddie Gondo gives us more from Bulawayo.
In a case filed by legal watchdog Veritas, Justice Joseph Mafusire at the Mashingo High Court ruled against the country's state media. Justice Mafusire ruled that state media had not given fair opportunity for the presentation of divergent views and dissenting opinions as required by the Constitution. The ruling involves the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation and the Zimbabwe Newspapers Group, which owns the Herald, the Sunday News, the Sunday Mail, and the Chronicle newspapers. Doug Cotard was the lead lawyer for Veritas.
This is a very important and landmark court ruling, which gives flesh to what would be acceptable and unacceptable, unconstitutional behavior by the state-owned media, which will be important for going forward. Now, enforcement of the order is really the priority, and ensuring that that the state media actually comply with the order. That's really the next hurdle.
Supporters of the case, however, question the timing of the ruling, given the case was filed before last year's national elections. Coulthard says the case had been filed as an urgent application. He says the judge agreed on the urgency of the matter and gave strict timelines for the filing of the papers at the time. He adds that he wrote to the court asking for a hearing in July 2018, but somehow the letter never reached the judge.
The judge actually states that in his judgment that letter was never placed before him, and that was the reason why this matter couldn't be heard before the election and ended up being heard after the election. As to whether there was a genuine mistake of someone in the registry's office, or whether there was some form of foul play to ensure that this matter wasn't heard before the election is anyone's guess.
The judge found the governing ZANU-PF party improperly enjoys disproportionate coverage in state media. The judge said that both news organizations must exercise impartiality and independence in editorial content. Some in the opposition say that while the judgment is a positive development, it is now largely academic. Swithan Chiwodza is a National Council member for the opposition MDC.
The first thing is that justice delayed is justice denied. The other thing as well is that the declaration also comes after ZANU-PF cast aspersions on the declaration or the report of the European Union and of the Republican Institute, wherein coverage was found to be biased in favor of ZPC.
The Minister of Information did not comment as the head of the ministry is away on business. ZANU-PF Secretary for Administration, Obed Mpofu, expressed surprise at the decision.
You know, we adhere and subscribe to the rule of law. And if there's such a judgment, we will look at the understand the import of it. Assuming that, you know, this the publicity they are talking about was free, but if this was bought, then it becomes something else. That's why it is important that we understand that the import of this judgment. We have not scrutinized the judgment. We will actually adjust it to our legal processes to understand exactly what the judgment is all about.
ZPC apparently raised the rates for advertising on its platforms, and the costs might have contributed to the skewed coverage. The MDC's Chiwodza says that was a significant hurdle.
During the time that Veritas brought the application, ZPC had made it very expensive for political parties other than ZANU-PF to carry or advertise their material on ZPC. They actually denied via cost. They could not pay cost of coverage.
In its defense, ZPC argued that MDC had not shared its schedule of events. Several election observer missions and media monitors found that ZANU-PF had garnered 87% of the political coverage on ZBC and 63% in Zinpepa's publications. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's list of prospective cabinet members is being screened for approval by the Senate. As Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, concerns have been raised about the small number of women recommended for the cabinet posts.
Confirmation of ministerial nominees.
For a second day Friday, names were vetted at Nigeria's National Assembly, 3 days after President Muhammadu Buhari turned in the list to the Senate for review. 43 people are under consideration, but only 7 of those, or 16%, are women. That's a concern for women's advocates like Justina Tochukwu.
The problem is not really women not participating. It is the support. I mean, when you indicate your interest in a particular office, how is it carried? How is it responded to? There is no support for these offices. So it's quite discouraging. It's not like women don't want to participate, but we don't have the support we need. We are continuously downplayed.
7% of women in Nigeria currently hold an elected position, even though they make up nearly 50% of the electorate. The 7% figure is one of the lowest in the world. But the Director General of Nigeria's National Orientation Agency, Garba Barry, says progress is being made.
It used to be 4, it was 6, now we are 7. Perhaps the next cabinet will be 10. Perhaps we may even get to the 30% affirmative action requirement. But we are seeing some incremental progress.
The percentage of women serving in government during President Muhammadu Buhari's first 4-year term, which began in 2015, was higher at about 17%. The president was re-elected in February. During his campaign for re-election, Buhari promised to improve the representation of women in his cabinet. Political experts such as Rotimi Olawale say the president has yet to keep that promise.
The president is coming more from a politics angle than a policy angle, and it's evident in the way that this list has come up. You have 9 former governors, 2 former deputy governors, a whole lot of former ministers.
But analysts says there could be a solution.
I think that women need to also negotiate more and to find ways by which they can sit at decision-making tables. And if such tables do not exist, they have to create their own tables and invite men to sit on it. I'm hoping that in the nearest future, we would have a woman president.
In the last decade, Nigeria has seen a greater involvement of women in education, business and the social sector. Nigeria is Africa's largest economy. Timothy Obiezu For VOA News, Abuja.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says global climate change coupled with explosive population growth will threaten world food security over the coming decades. To find out more about what is and can be done, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with André Laperrière, Executive Director of Global Open Data for Agriculture and Nutrition, or GODAN. He began by discussing one of the challenges.
One of the challenges with the knowledge generators is that oftentimes both the volume as well as the technical level of what they generate is a bit too remote from farmers' day-to-day reality. So part of our challenge is to work with both parties to identify the most relevant elements in a way that suddenly resonates with the farmers, that makes sense to them, and that is easy to use. Farmers don't need big data, but they need the fruits of big data to identify these pests that are harming their crops or their infestations that are also impeding what they're doing in farming.
How dependent on access to high technology or even computers is this transmission?
That's a very good question. In many emerging countries right now, I'm thinking of places like South Africa or Ethiopia, where you have these young startups that provide the benefits of precision agriculture to regular farmers and farmers' associations. They provide maps of their farms or their regions indicating which part is infested or which part is too dry or which part needs fertilizers.
Part of the ethos of this fascinates me also, the idea that it's open. I mean, so much of the inequality between subsistence farmers and corporate or agricultural businesses is that they own all these satellites and have all this incredible information that is then not usually available to people on the ground who need it.
That's very true, because it's one thing to say that, oh yeah, sure, satellite imagery is free and it's available, but not everybody can use it really, because it's technically not so easy. That's why we have these intermediaries, all these often young, passionate people that are developing all kinds of open source tools to make it easily understandable and usable. Private companies, they make money. That's their reason for existing. So when they invest in research, they want to make sure that they recoup their investment. However, the overall source of a lot of the data that makes a big difference in areas such as precision agriculture, precision irrigation, and so on, is free. Where there are restrictions is oftentimes in the applications that companies might have developed or using it, but it does not prevent others from using the same source as well.
Do you have any models for ways that can accommodate both the concerns of the small farmers and the large corporations that own these satellites and this data?
I could think of one that I can share with you, which I think is reasonable. Some people may feel otherwise, but a company, which I will maybe not name now, has developed applications using smartphones with a very high level of precision to identify pests, be it insects or diseases. So if I'm in the middle of my cornfield and I see suddenly all these strange insects that are killing my maize and that I've never seen before, and nobody in my neighborhood has seen them before, with this app, just with the click of a thumb, you take a picture, and then within seconds, it goes to the headquarters of that company. And then using big data, it compares it to millions of other records until it finds the perfect match. And then within seconds, it comes back to you and it tells you, this insect is this, what it does is that, and the best way to get rid of it is this. And then they will say, and by the way, we sell products that can also do the trick. So that's how they recoup their investment. But what is nice is that you don't need to buy their product. Now that you know who your enemy is, so to speak, you might find some other traditional, organic, or some other means to get rid of it, because at least you have identified your problem. So you see, it's bringing big data, image recognition, which are very technical, in the hands of regular farmers in a very simple way that's very user-friendly. And yet, it still allows the company to recoup the investment they did in keeping the system running.
That was André Laperrière, Executive Director of GODAN, an international nonprofit. He was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.